This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
I have to say that summer in 89 that I came here, I'm not going to tell that story, it's a different lecture, but it was an absolutely transformative summer in my life that really put me on a path that Judaism and it is for me and Torah is for me. So I'm very grateful to Pardes. It's wonderful to be here to do a lecture. I'm going to stand. I like to stand and move around. And this is going to be a mix of, I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes, and you can ask questions during that time. We'll do an exercise. I'll talk some more. We'll do another exercise and some learning. So it'll be a mix of frontal and you guys also being real involved. The topic is Musar as a spiritual path, Jewish spiritual path. Raise your hand if you've heard of Musar. Right? That never would have happened 10 years ago. Okay, raise your hand if you've actually practiced Musar. Yeah, much less. Okay, so things are changing. Musar is coming back in consciousness of the Jewish world. But by the practice, it's like really doing Musar is, it's really in the practice. So we have a ways to go to get people involved. And I hope what I say today and what we do today will encourage you to find a group, find a place to practice. Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of the Jewish community in Palestine or this area that became Israel, he tells a story that when he was a young person in Lithuania in Eastern Europe, the small communities, the shtetls, had shuls organized, the synagogues organized by profession. There was the hat maker shul, there was the carpenter shul, there was different shuls. And well, it's a proof that talking in shul was always a thing, because you have your talking shop. But so they had hat makers, shoemakers, and they had a horse thieves shul. So right there, there's a problem, right? There's a problem in the community that there's this gap between our ethics, what we know is right, our Torah, our teachings, our mitzvot, and our actual practice. Musar comes to bridge that gap between what we know is right in our heads, the motivation we feel in our hearts, and the actions we do with our hands. It comes to bring those and bind those together. Rabbi Eliel Opian, one of the great Musar teachers of the early 20th century, said the farthest distance in the world is from the head to the heart. Mm-hmm. So Musar comes to really break that down and open that up. That was Rabbi Elia Lopian, L-O-P-I-A-N.
Thank you.
Okay. So Musar's goal, and I'm going to say, explain to you in a minute what Musar means, literally, but Musar's goal is to bridge this gap, to create menshes, to create full human beings who have integrity of their values and their actions. It's to comes to create a vessel and an ability to receive Torah and internalize Torah. A question is asked in the Middle Ages, is there any mitzvah in the Torah? We say we have 613 mitzvot traditionally. Is there any mitzvah in the Torah for working on your character traits, your midot, for becoming a better person? And there's not. And Rabbi Chaim Vital, a medieval scholar, says that the reason is because, and he says this is Hebrew, I'll translate, he says, derech eretz kadma l'Torah. Good behavior and good midot, good character, precedes Torah. That you actually need to have that. And that's what the story of the patriarchs and the matriarchs are coming before receiving Torah at Sinai. That we need to actually be able to hear and receive Torah. And that takes working on ourselves. So that's another goal. And finally, I'd say the biggest goal of Musar is Kedusha, or holiness. And Musar goes back to Leviticus 19, the holiness code that says, be holy because I am holy. And what is holiness? We have a difference of opinion among the commentators, but one idea is that holiness is when you live with integrity, when you're allowed to do something and you do it with your highest values. So the Ramban, Nachmanides, says that you can be a novel reshut Torah. You can be a scoundrel with Torah license, you know? You can eat all the kosher food in the world and be a huge glutton, especially here in this country. So it's not... So I'm saved very often by the fact that food's not kosher, because I won't eat it. But here, so it's the decision to actually you know, behave according to your values and right, even when you can get away with something else, that's holiness. That's holiness, because we live with integrity. So those are all, it's a lot of goals. Those are all Musar's goals, are to do that. So my personal connection, how I got into this, was I was at a traditional yeshiva, and where in that yeshiva, like most traditional yeshivas, and Pardes is somewhat like this, a little bit different, where you study Gemara, you study the Talmud all morning from like 9 to 1, lunch, and then you study Halakha, Jewish law, and more Gemara from like 3 to 8. And then at night, people study more Gemara. So the students at this yeshiva were complaining, and they wanted more spirituality. They're like, this is, you know, Jewish law has, you know, some connection with it. It can be a little dry. It's also could be spiritual, but it could be a little dry, like studying how many oxes gore cows and what, you know, that goes on. So they wanted spirituality. So the rabbi said, okay, we'll give you spirituality. We'll have a 10-minute Musar unit in the morning at 9 o'clock, from 9 to 9:10. So we thought that was a joke, like 10 minutes. But it worked, actually. It was in that 10-minute thing we were learning. Actually, it's funny, not a Musar, and I'll explain some of these differences in a minute, but more from a Hasidic tradition, someone called the Netivot Shalom, Rabbi Berezovsky, about Midot, about this Midot meaning this character traits, soul traits, trust, patience, these kind of things. And we're learning the source about how the Torah wants us to be courageous, trusting people. And I was blown away. Like, this is amazing. This is what I want for myself. And I didn't know that we had this technology and these teachings and these practices in our own tradition. So I got really into it and got connected to Rabbi Shlomo Volbe, who passed away about 11, 12 years ago now in Jerusalem. But he was really one of the greatest Musar teachers of the generation, particularly in the Haredi world, the ultra-Orthodox world. But he also reached out, had a wide following in the modern Orthodox world as well. And thank God now spreading out even broader than that into the broader liberal Jewish world. So that I got into it really then. It felt like a path to live with an open heart, to live with moral courage. And as Rabbi Tzvi Miller, who's a Musar teacher in Beit Shemesh, he says, Musar comes to help us build bulletproof self-esteem. That basically you kind of have such a sense of internal compass that, you know, you're not thrown off by all the things that life comes to teach you. Actually, I wrote an article last year as an aside that hopefully will be coming out this year about Rabbi Yitz Greenberg and his life. And many people probably know him as an advocate for pluralism and interfaith relations, and has really taken a lot of heat throughout his life. He was a scholar in residence here last year, 2 years ago. Really taken a lot of heat throughout his career as really being out there and pushing women's rights, you know, good human relations, human rights, everything. And he credits his ability to do that with his Musar background. He studied for 4 years in a Musar yeshiva in Brooklyn, and he talks about that building this intense moral compass, inner compass, that you're really not shaken by criticism. So I liked all those things. Those seem like good things to bring into my life. So I got really into Musar. Okay, what is Musar? The word Musar can be translated a lot of ways. It means ethics in modern Hebrew. It can mean discipline. The translation I like of it, understanding, comes from Psalm 34, where it says, "Sur mira va'aseh tov," turn from wickedness and do good. Sur mira, sur is to turn. So Musar is a discipline that helps us turn in a direction that we want to go in our lives. Bottom line, we are souls. We're not just a body and a soul. We are souls, and we have to inhabit bodies in our journey through this world. Each of us has what Alan Marinus calls a soul curriculum. Each person has their own individual soul curriculum that we're given when we're born, and the tasks in our life are to figure that out and to master it to the best degree we can. And you know your soul curriculum by looking at, you know, what kind of things keep hitting you in the head? What challenges keep coming? You know, I have a friend who keeps getting in the same bad relationship with the same kind of person over and over again in his life. So there's something on his soul curriculum about that type of relationship. And so you can think, what seem to be the tests that come your way? And those kind of things are elements on your soul curriculum that, you know, you've been given to figure out and to deal with. So we all have our own individualized soul curriculum. We also all have a divine soul. We're made in the image of God. We have a pure soul. And the problem, though, is we don't show that all the time. We don't shine it out all the time. Musar teacher Rabbi David Lapin, who's related to Rabbi Eliyahu Lapin, who I mentioned before, but he lives now. He's an amazing guy. He's an international business consultant and Musar teacher on the side. He says that we have a Tzelem Elohim, or a divine image, but we only manifest that when we make choices against our lower instincts. Okay, let me say that again. We have a divine image, but most of the time we're acting like robots in life, and we're just kind of acting according to habituation. But when we come into these points where we feel a pull towards something that's really not really the right thing to do, we're pulled, and we can decide against that, that's when our divine image shines. And the more we can make those kind of choices, the more divinity we bring into the world, the more we shine our divine image. Rabbi Shlomo Volbe, who I mentioned before, who I had an opportunity to learn from and learn from his students and his books, he has an essay where he writes that the essential state of the world is one of closeness, connection, he calls it yedidut, of friendship, kochot yedidut in the world, friendship and amity. He says that humans and the material world, the stones, the dust of the earth, we're connected to them because that's what we're made of. We're made of the dust of the earth. We're connected to plant life. Plants grow, so we grow, so we're connected to them. We're connected to animals, and it's beyond obvious how all human beings are connected. He says there's really no races in the world. It's really, we're actually all one humankind. So he says, why? What's the problem? Why do we live with such violence and such separation if that's the essential state of the world that God created? He says that Rabbi Ibn Ezra, medieval commentator, he says that the word achzar, achzariyut, means cruelty. The root of that word, is it okay to write up here? The root of that word, so achzar is cruel, is Kavzayin Resh, which means czar is a stranger. Kit czar, when we make people like strangers to us, when we alienate and we become strange to ourselves, that's the root of cruelty. That's where cruelty comes from. And he says, why would we ever do this? Why would we ever become estranged? And he says, that's because something we call the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is the evil inclination, the inner adversary, some people call it. But it's that, it's something in us that leads us to separate from other people. And it's in that separation where cruelty can grow. And so Rav Volbe's Musar, really that's what we're really trying to do when we're working on our character traits and our soul traits, is to overcome that and to move towards kirva, to move towards closeness and connection with other people. Okay, so that's like background. Any questions at this point? I want to give you a very brief history, then we're going to do an exercise. Yeah?
You mentioned that being pulled towards a particular area, and that's the Yetzer Hara. How are we able to differentiate what is pulling us, if that is good or if that is bad?
The pulls?
Yeah.
It's hard. It takes a lot of discernment. But the Yetzer tends to be, Yetzer means form. Yetzer, to form something, Yetzer. It tends to be a unstable energy that drives for instant gratification. So if it has that feel to it, that you feel some kind of, and you have to be very aware, very self-aware to do Musar. But if it has this feel to it that you're being pulled towards like something like you just want to like get it over with, or you just want it. You just want it now. That's probably Yetzer Hara energy. Doesn't mean you always shouldn't follow it, but you should at least know what it is. Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, who was one of the great Musar teachers of the 20th century, he writes that you can tell by the way people approach things. Does someone, if it's coming from Yetzer Hara, Yetzer Tov, does someone approach something with kind of a desperation and urgency, or do they approach it with a sense of calm? It's called Yishuv Dat, equanimity. And that's, you can tell if there's Yetzer Hara behind it by that urgency and that desperation. Okay? And again, I'm not going to go on a whole talk on Yetzer Hara. It's a different talk. But Yetzer Hara, I like to approach it as morally neutral. It's called Ra, which is bad in Hebrew. But I think it's more of a, it's an unstable force. But it's the seed of our creativity, the seed of our passion. So there's a lot to say about it. But it's not simple. It's not like a simple bad, red devil, never follow it, and angel, follow it. It's much more complicated than that in Musar and in Judaism. Okay, a little bit of history, and then we'll move to an exercise. So Musar really is as old, as I said before, as old as the Tanakh, as old as the Torah, back to Leviticus, back to Deuteronomy, back to Devarim, Moshe's speech. Moses' speech in Deuteronomy is a lot of Musar. It's giving ethical instruction. We find ethical instruction also in the prophets. We find it in the Mishnah, in the Pirkei Avot, in the literature of the rabbis of about 2,000 years ago, the beginning of the Oral Torah. There's lots of aphorisms about how you should live, the ways you should treat other people. That's Musar. What we don't get in biblical and early rabbinic literature is any instruction about how do we do these things? How do we become more trusting? How do we develop humility? How do we live with these traits? We're not told. The rabbis were the rabbis of the Talmud were very private about, or at least the Talmud was private, about what their individual personal practices were. We don't have stories of, you know, someone keeping a journal or running out to the woods and talking to God. We have a little bit, but not a lot. We don't get that kind of backstory of people's private lives and how they developed and how Rabbi Akiva became Rabbi Akiva. We get a little bit. You know, we went to and he studied Torah at age 40 and learned, but the midot, the character traits, we don't really get that much. And so it took another 800 years until the Jewish world started producing literature that was more practical about this is how you develop it. So one of the first Musar books to come along was in the 11th century. It was called, in Hebrew, Chovot HaLevavot, or The Duties of the Heart, by Rabbi Bachya Ibn Pakuda. And Rabbi Bachya was a judge in Spain, a Jewish judge, and a dayan. And there was a whole milieu at that time of Sufi influence that was very much meditation and development of the self through practices. So he wrote this book that had chapters on trust, humility, faith in God, all these different character traits, and with meditations, with practices, how to develop them. That started a thousand-year genre of what we call Musar literature, really from about 1,000 up until today, in every corner of the Jewish world. So you get it in rationalist Spain with Maimonides, he's writing Musar books. You have it with the Kabbalists of Spain, with Nachmanides and his students. You have it with the Kabbalists of Sfat here, also writing Musar books. 19th century, then finally come along in the late 19th century, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was the greatest Torah scholar of his generation. And he looked around and he saw that the Judaism that was being practiced in Eastern Europe and Lithuania in that time, there was an elite that was learning Torah, and the yeshiva world really was just like getting going around then in the 19th century. And so the elite was learning. Most of the Jews were pretty much just kind of going along a conformist religious life. And he saw that the Enlightenment, which was started in Western Europe in the 18th century, was coming east. And ideas of modernity, equality, open societies. And he saw that there's no way that this Judaism, the way people are practicing it, is going to stand up to modernity when it comes. The religion is way too conformist and not internalized. And so he said, we have to internalize Judaism. We have to internalize it, and we have to pick up our ethical game. The story I told at the beginning of the horse thieves' shul is like, this is not going to go when modernity comes, because one of the things modernity really values is good ethical relations, so at least on paper. So he's like, we have to, like, Jews are going to abandon Judaism. So we have to pick up the game. So he saw that we can study Torah all day long. If it's just in our heads, it's not going to change our behavior. We're not going to grow. It has to break through. It has to break through to the emotions. So he created an internal revolution in Orthodoxy of the yeshiva world in Lithuania in that time of introducing practices that were geared towards getting out of the head into the heart. One of those practices called hispilus is where you learn very fervently. This is one of my favorite stories from Rabbi Greenberg. He talks about when his dad was bringing him to his the yeshiva for the first time to check it out and see if he wanted to go there. He was 14 years old, and it's in Brooklyn. It's called the Beit Yosef Yeshiva. And they go in, and it was about 7 o'clock, so they were just about to start. It was called the Night Seder. And they're sitting there, and someone, they sit down, someone bangs on a table, and this guy next to him jumps up, and he's got a talis on his head, and he's got his, you know, Tanakh open, and he starts screaming out, Kina, Taiva, Bekavo, Marvin Adam, and Zolalam. He starts screaming out jealousy, seeking honor, and it makes a person leave the world. And this person starts screaming it out and crying and going for about a half hour. All around the Beit Midrash, everyone else is standing up with talis on the head, screaming and crying, and these different verses from the Torah. This goes on for a half hour. He and his dad have no idea what's going on. At the end of the half hour, someone bangs on the table again. Everyone sits down, and it's over as quick as it started. And young Rabbi Yitzchak Greenberg turns to his dad and says, I want to go here. So that was, but that was one of the practices called learning bispilus. Bispilus or hit pa'alut is to mean activated, to be activated. And so Rabbi Yisrael said we can't just learn Torah in our heads. We need to really bring it into our hearts, and we need to have fervor. We need to sweat. We need to like be worked up when we learn. Not all day, but for like a half hour. Just do this for a half hour, and it'll change your life. And so his students really did that, and you know, they created an internal revolution in the yeshiva world of bringing Musar in and bringing these practices in. Now, it only succeeded to a certain point, because after about 30, 40 years, it got tamed. And because people thought this was very weird, which it is. But, you know, but it's okay. Like, we need to do strange things. But people said, I don't want to quote exactly, but one of the great Torah leaders of the time said that this is for sick people. Musar is for sick people. Because these things they were doing were so extreme. But people really saw that they could change their life. Rav Yisrael said that it's harder to change one midah, one character trait, than to learn the whole Talmud. That to really do change, really, to really change is that hard. But that's what Musar really came to do. So out of Rav Yisrael's work, there came three main schools of Musar. There came and they all had different personalities. The Kelm school was the earliest one. And that really emphasized, now I'm totally like being reductionist about it, but that emphasized the obligation to the other and carrying the burden with the other. The Slobodka school emphasized the greatness of the human. And so we should grow because we're so great. Like humans are made in the divine image. That's amazing. So it lifts us up. The Novartic school emphasized more of kind of humans' lowliness and working on building extreme trust in God. So Novartic, if anyone's read the book or heard of it, the yeshiva, that takes that. And it was easy to kind of caricature, because they would do unusual things to build trust. So the altar in Novartic, the leader of the school, to help people deal with different traits. So one guy was scared. He had lots of fears and anxiety. So his thing for him was, I want you to go to the cemetery, and I want you to go there alone. And I want you to say psalms by this grave right in the middle of the cemetery all night. And so the other students would go, and this guy would go up to the grave, and the other students would stand at the gate of the cemetery, not letting him out. And he would do that. It was like extreme, like, kind of outward bound type things. They would also, you know, send people away on a train, like, really far away with no money. I'd be like, okay, get back. And like, without any money. So it got a bad reputation for these kind of things. But the people who it produced, like really, they were able to go across Russia before World War I and start 120 yeshivas because they weren't afraid of anything. And it was an amazing thing. But those are the three schools. There's one, to give you an example, and this is a general point about Musar, the Slobodka people would dress very nicely because the greatness, it was called Gadlus Adam, the greatness of a person. They would dress like, you know, really nice and top hats and all, you know, because that's like a human being. And so there's a story one time where a bunch of Slobodka guys went to the Novartic yeshiva. And in the Novartic yeshiva, they were sitting around a table, and hanging from the ceiling was a decaying fish. And they're like, why do you have a decaying fish? They said, because we're trying to really understand mortality and the fact that all flesh rots, and we want to really internalize that idea. And like, that's gross. That's like totally undignified to have a rotting fish in your Beit Midrash. And so they went back to the altar of Slobodka, the head of the Slobodka yeshiva, and they said, do you believe what these Novartic guys are doing? And their leader said to them, well, does it work? So that's a very important principle in Musar, is it's not rigid as far as like, do this or that. It's does it work? Which is why it's very open to modern psychology, to like different techniques, and really those are integrated in different ways. So Rav Olbe, who again was the teacher I mentioned, he was very aware of Dewey's writings and other, just a kind of modern thinking. We want to know, does it work? How do humans work? And we're learning more and more continuously how humans work, but also with eternal Torah principles. So it's that combination. Okay. Questions? Okay. So I've been talking about midot. Midot are character traits. So David Lappin, Rabbi Lappin, has a nice analogy for how these work and why they're important. He says that if you imagine an airplane, has, you want to tell how high or low you're going. The pilot will look at the altimeter, right? It has an instrument that tells you how high or low it's going. He says human beings also, we have instruments to tell how we're doing. We have our bodies. What's going on with our bodies? Are we injured? Do we have pain somewhere? That's an instrument. It gives us data about ourselves. We have our relationship. I'll get to that. We have our emotions. What's our mood? What's happening emotionally? That's information. We have our relationships with other human beings, the quality of those relationships. That's information. And we have our spirituality, which could be our relationship to Torah, our relationship to God. The quality of those relationships gives us information. So just like the pilot, the plane's flying too high, wants to go down, the pilot's not going to bang on or press the altimeter. They have to find the down button on the plane and press the control. So with us as human beings. If we're having a problem in a relationship, we shouldn't bang on the other person. That's not the problem. We have to go inside. We have to use our controls. What are our controls? They're our midot. They're our character traits. They're our patience, our sense of dignity, our trust, our courage, all those things. That's where we have leverage. That's where our controls are. We need to use those. So in Musar, the first move is always in and looking at, okay, well, what am I contributing to this? What's happening with me? What's happening on midot? What could I possibly change? And then, if we need to, we give tochacha, rebuke, or whatever, we have that conversation. But the first move is inside. And so we need to know the inner landscape. We need to know that landscape to know how it's going. Rav always says we're building our inner worlds with Musar. So I want to do a short exercise. I've been talking a lot now. I want to give you a list of midot, of character traits. And this is not comprehensive. Let me pass these around. Oh, do you have it in front? Yeah. Is that passed out? You have it. pass these around. So it's again, it's not comprehensive. A friend, a colleague of mine, Lisa Goodman, who teaches Musar in Boston with me, compiled this. And it's drawn from a couple of different sources. I should say one more note on history. So after the Musar movement in the early 20th century, these three yeshivas, things kind of petered out. They transformed into different yeshivas over time, but the Shoah really took the wind out of the Musar movement. Are we okay? People getting it?
Yeah, Richard,
let's get it back here. Okay, so as I said, the Shoah really, wiped out many, many, many of the great Musar teachers, but it reconstructed itself somewhat, but really very little in the late 20th century. And about the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a revival. There's been a renaissance of interest in Musar. I think Rav Volbe was a big part of that here in Israel. He took it on himself, because so much was lost in the Holocaust, to be the communicator of Musar to this generation. And thank God he did that. And then in the North America, there's been a couple things. Dr. Alan Marinus of the Musar Institute for the last 15 years has been popularizing Musar across North America. My guess, I could be wrong, my guess is why so many people raise their hand when I said, have you heard of Musar, is due to him. and I served on his board. He's a fantastic mentor of mine, and I love him very much. Rabbi Ira Stone in Philadelphia also has been popularizing Musar. And so that's what we have today. So there really is a renaissance. Okay, what I'd like you to do is think about your own soul curriculum, okay? This list, again, it's not comprehensive, but it's got a lot of midot on here. And we have the Hebrew transliteration and English. I'd like you to identify three midot that you feel are on your soul curriculum. Now, how do we know? You'll know. If what comes up in your life? What seems to be there that you're struggling with, or that seems to be a strength? And of those three, I'd like you to find one that's a strong mida. That's like, this is really, I got this one. This is really strong for me. Question?
Is a soul curriculum meaning a thing that's most difficult for you, or something that
you're best at? So that's a good question. It's generally, we think of it at places where you struggle, but I think it's also where your strength is, because you can use that strength to leverage the other midot. That's a big principle in Musar. Rabbi Rucham Lavovitz, who is the spiritual advisor at the Mir Yeshiva in Europe and now down in Meisharim, he had the idea that we all have at least one strong midah, that if we use that, it can really influence everything else. So for example, for me, mine I think is gevura, or is discipline. I have a lot of discipline. And so I can use that. I might be weak in other things. So my seder, my organization might not be so good. I can run late to things, lose things. So, but if I want to really work on that, I could use my discipline to take that on. So, for example, if I set up a program for myself of, okay, I'm going to get places 5 minutes early every day, like every meeting for this week, I'll stick to that because I have the discipline to do it. So that's using my strong midah to work on something that might be weaker. So that's what I like to do. Find two that are need some work, and then one that you feel is like really strong that could be a leverage. Okay, and do this by yourself. And I'll give you a couple minutes. If you are here with someone who knows you really well, you can check with them and say, does that sound right to you? Okay. Let's come back together. Any questions about this, or what you were sure about, or how'd that go? You feel like you found the strong midah? Raise your hand if you feel like you found the strong midah.
If you have one.
Yeah. Okay. I'm good. Good. That's good to see. Because that's really, I think, the most important. Because if you have that, you then can use that on anything else. Okay. Good. Okay. Any questions about that or soul curriculum? All right. Yeah.
Well, it's specific to work.
Well, let's do it now and then.
Okay. I'm curious about emunah, faith in God. Mm-hmm. Does that look the same for all people? Is there a definition of what it means to have emunah? Because the concept of God seems to matter a lot there.
Right? Yeah, I mean, there's faith in God, there's also trust in God. And so that's something, again, that's going to be a stretch for some people. But emunah generally, how you get to emunah could look very different for different people. But emunah is that there is a creator and, something bigger, kind of there. But you don't have to start there. You could have emunah in nature or emunah in the world. There's like ways you can kind of build towards that. Yeah, the midot are all, I should say, the midot function along an axis of, so for example, patience would be on an axis of apathy on the one hand and uncontrollable rage on the other. And so then patience comes somewhere in that middle. And so what you do is a midah literally means a measure. And in medieval thought, the belief was, the understanding was that we had measures of certain amount of things, a certain measure of patience, a certain measure of trust. And it's we're all going to be different there. And so we want to know what's our measure. We want to know how do I measure up on that? And this is really in our response to stimuli that come in. How do I react? How much patience? How much trust? How much all these different things? That's our midah. And so those midot are on an axis. And, one way of thinking about it is, it's very oversimplified, but if you have the sun, right? Imagine the sun is the soul and it shines. And then you have the clouds. The clouds come. The clouds will be the midot. And the clouds can cover the sun. If the midot are not aligned or out of whack, you can cover the sun. It's always there. It's like the neshama is always there. The soul is always there. The sun's there. But we're doing in this work, which is also called tikkun midot, or the transformation of the midot, or the ha'alata midot, the raising up of the midot. These are different terms for it. We're aligning that. So the clouds are just there so the sun can shine through. And that's what we can do in this practice, is just move those midot a little bit, a little more patience, a little less patience. Maybe some people need less patience. No midah is like all good or all bad. That's a very important idea. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, we need every midah and its opposite, because at any particular moment, you may need to pull out something. And so it's not like you just settle in like, oh yeah, I'm good at this and that's it. Because you may need, if you're a really patient person, you may need to be angry sometimes, Or if you're like really humble, you may need to actually be proud sometimes. So it's not like it's all, they're static in any way. Okay. Yeah.
Is there a hierarchy to midot, or do they carry equal weight, or are they grouped somehow?
I would say there are some that we tend to study more. If you look in the Musar books, humility. I'd say that's probably like the biggest one. And that shows up first in many, many Musar books. I think because a Musar understanding of humility is that we are really trying to figure out how to be right sized. This is something Alan Marinus, I think, has made very clear, that it's not taking too little space or too much space. And then that's very dynamic. And it also is the midah that's the most about our own relationship, our self-understanding, and the world around us. I think that's why it comes first so much. And then savanut is another really big one, which is forbearance, being able to bear things, being able to bear discomfort. That's another big one. Yeah. Okay. Alrighty, so how does this? How do we do this? How do we manipulate these midot? How do we grow? What's the theory of change in Musar? I want to talk for a few minutes about that, the theory of change. And again, I'm going to go to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter again, because he laid this out in his writings. So there's three things. And I don't know if they're really steps or not, or it's more circular. He described it in a linear way. The first is something called hergesh, or sensitivity. That you want to develop sensitivity about your inner life and know your midot. You want to feel things deeply. He gives an analogy of a butcher, who the knife that the butcher uses has to be perfect. It can't have any little nick in it. And so the shochet, the butcher, gets very good at running his finger carefully along the edge to feel if there's any little teeny, teeny nick in it. And it's called, the Talmud says, it uses the term hergesh for that, hargasha, that he's going to have a small feeling for it. He says that's the kind of sensitivity we're talking about. Not hergesh in terms of emotions, like I feel sad, I feel happy, but a real sensitivity to when something might be beginning in us, you know? Like when a thought just starts emerging that ends up being the thing that leads to some really bad behavior. So I'm going to use something like mundane as an example. This is in my life. There's one of my big, we call taivas, your things, you know, desires that aren't so healthy is for salty chips. Like, so, you know, it's basically anything that has carbohydrates and oil and salt on it. And so, and I will tend to most indulge in those after 10 p.m. in front of the computer. So there could be like, you know, early on in the evening as, you know, we're having dinner, cleaning up at 6 o'clock, 6:30, this kind of thought of like, oh, you know, after everyone gets to bed, finally I'll sit down in front of the computer and like get a bag of chips, you know, and eat it. And like if I catch that thought, it's like this teeny little thought that like it might just like pass by really quickly in the rush of what's going on. But if I'm really, really sensitive, I can notice that little thought coming in that is going to build as the evening goes on. And then, okay, I get the kids to sleep, and now everyone's asleep, and I'm alone, and it's like, now it's like full on, okay, raging, and I can't go back from it. So we all have those things. And so what hergesh is developing the awareness that we can catch those things really early. Like, oh, I know that. I know where that's going to go, and be able to call it. But that takes a real sensitivity to do that. Different practices in the Musar tradition for doing that. Some are what I explained before, that he's pious, like learning in a fervent way, kind of gets you aware of your inner life. What's called cheshbon nefesh, soul accounting, and doing a regular journeying of thinking back the day, what were things that came up during the day, and getting aware of yourself that way. That's another practice we do. So the next level is called kibush. Kibush literally means conquering. It's kind of a militaristic term. And I like to think of it as using the power of our decision. So Rabbi Israel writes that once we have a lot of hergesh, once we get really sensitive to who we are and can tell these little things. You know, I just taught all this stuff at a meditation retreat, a mindfulness retreat, a couple weeks ago. And there we were talking a lot about how mindfulness meditation can really be a practice of hergesh, of building that sensitivity, you know, of little thoughts and as they come in. So once you really get that sensitivity, then it becomes a lot easier to make a decision. You're like, okay, you know what? I'm not gonna do that. I'm actually gonna shut the computer before 10 tonight. I'm not gonna send that one email because I know once I send that one email, then I'm in front of the computer. So we can make the decision. Once we have that sensitivity, it's easier to do it. But kibush has a kind of kibush. It's kind of a tough. It's a conquering. So I think there is an idea of that you just can like make the decision, I'm not going to do it. That can work to a certain degree. But unless you've done the hergesh and really built sensitivity, it's only going to have somewhat successful, you know, by like being like, no, I'm not, you know, whatever, going to do this thing. I'm not going to have that cookie or whatever it is. So we want to build the hergesh first. But that is using our power of a decision to say no to certain things or yes to others. The highest level, though, is what Rabbi Yisrael calls tikkun. Tikkun or transformation. And he says tikkun, and this is tikkun hayetzer. Tikkun is when you have so much joy in doing the right thing, like a real felt experience of joy, of living well of living your highest ideals, of doing well by other people, and you can feel that joy, he says that it's going to just drag your Yetzer Hara after it. You don't even need to decide anymore once you get to that place, because you've built such motivation and such drive to do the right thing that, you know, you're there. You're just going to do the right thing. And he says that's really the ultimate goal of Musar, is to get to that place that we're almost beyond choice, which is, it's paradoxical, because free will and choice is what makes us human. So I think it's much more aspirational. I'm not sure if anyone's gotten there. And he says that, you know, you always need to keep cultivating that power of decision, the kibush, because even though you might get the tikkun, you might have transformed in some way, you're going to get ambushed at different points by things that are going to come up in life that are going to drag you down that you hadn't seen in 20 years, and they're going to press your buttons again. So you better keep the muscle strong for being able to say no to things. But really what we're trying to do is build love, and build love of living as our highest selves. And that'll put us on the right path. So that's the theory of change in doing all these practices that I'm going to talk about in a little bit. Questions about that before I go on? Yeah.
I think what you said makes, I mean, although the concept is unfamiliar in terms of our spiritual self, as a concept it's very familiar. You want to run somewhere, you want to train for a marathon, at first it's really difficult, but the more you do it, the easier it becomes. The more you start rewarding, you stop having to persuade yourself to go out the door to do the run. Maybe you're trying to watch what you eat. At first it's really hard to say no, but if you do a couple of pounds shift, it becomes self-rewarding. And so, yeah. I mean, it's a lovely idea to actually apply that to our spiritual self.
Isn't it? Yeah.
I get my spiritual diet, but that sounds wrong, because the end is a good one.
Well, they call the cheshbon a nefesh. These things, right? Cheshbon is an accounting. It's from the business world. But they said a soul accounting. They took a lot of things we know from the material world that work and made it a spiritual practice. Yeah. Yeah.
How helpful is it, I guess, in that first level of where you're accounting, that first thought comes in about, I want those potato chips, of, I guess, going deeper even into your history, and, you know, where does that desire come from?
Yeah.
How helpful is that?
Yeah, I think that's all part of Hergesh. Now, Rav Volpe was very clear in his Musar that he said this is not therapy. It's not therapy. So we don't dwell in the past, and that's not what we're doing. We're really looking more in the present and the future and trying to grow spiritually. So it's important. This has a lot of overlaps with what we do in therapy, but I think having that awareness is certainly part of Hergesh. So I want to do an exercise with us now that gets at Hergesh, that gets at the sensitivity. And it's something Rav Volpe, it was very important to his Musar, which is in Hebrew called Hit Lam Dut. Hit Lam Dut means, it's the Hit Pael form, the reflexive form of being a learner, from Lama, Lilmod, Lam Mem Dalet, being a learner. So it means to be a reflexive learner, or to take a stance of learning towards everything in life. And Hit Lam Dut for Rav Volpe, it really preceded everything, because he said that there's a problem when you start learning Musar. Two problems. One is that you'd be working on becoming more patient, doing all these things. You look around at all the other people that aren't doing this and think, oh, look at those schleppers. They're not really growing. They're not really working on themselves. I've experienced that when around eating. My wife and I have a very strict diet. We did certain points. So I'd be at my school at the cafeteria, and I'd be eating my salad, and I look around at people with pizza and fries. I just feel so superior. And that's like the worst thing for your spiritual life, is to feel superior to anyone. And so he says that that's one problem in learning Musar, is you can get arrogant. The other problem is you can become self-critical. This very easily can turn on yourself when you start really looking at yourself so much. So he said that this practice of Hit Lam Dut, of being a learner, is essential, because what it does is it makes everything into practice. So if I'm working on being patient, it's like that I'm not actually patient, or I'm not accomplishing being patient. I'm just practicing being patient. I'm not a patient person, but what would a patient person do? Who is patient? Well, I can think about that, but I'm not patient. And he goes so far as to say that even to the day you die, that you're not really dying, you're just learning how to die. So everything in life is about learning how. And he says that he wanted his students always to have that perspective on life in everything, and when you're working on midot. And in his book, he always says, every midah you get to, kavod, anything, dignity, anything, he says, now we're going to mit lamed this. We're going to mit lamed. We're going to mit lamed. We're going to practice this to learn. So Hit Lam Dut has two functions. One is it's about making things like, how is this speaking to me right now? What can I learn from this interaction? What can I learn from this piece of Torah? What can I learn from that cat? Like, what can I learn from me right now? And how does this impact me? And things are new. not thinking things are rote living. Like, that's the enemy, is living in a rote way, no matter what you're doing, but seeing things as new. The mindfulness people call it beginner's mind. It's seeing things as new. So I'd like us to do a Hit Lam Du practice right now. Two different ones. I want us to start with the natural world. And being a learner based on something from natural world. I picked up a bunch of leaves on my way over here. Let's try to not crumble them and make a mess. They're very dry. If we can just take one and pass them around, this should be enough for everyone. If we run out, we'll figure something else for you to use. Here. And the exercise, to do Hit Lam Du, you have to be interested in yourself. You have to be interested in how things work for yourself. So there's a difference between learning something and being in Hit Lam Du with something. You can learn something, it's really in your head. Hit Lam Du is, what's the learning for me? And how does this apply to me right now? It's a different kind of learning. And according to the Rambam, the Maimonides, in his Laws of Learning Torah, he says that's really the goal of learning Torah, is Hit Lam Du. Okay. Does anyone not have one?
I think we only have one in that corner.
That corner didn't get? Let me see if I have anything else. I may have to give you other things that are not from the natural. I'll tell you what. Oh, I have some. Here, take a date or a nut or something. That's okay. You take those. I just want everyone to have one thing, and then you can eat it afterwards. I want everyone to have one thing from the natural world. That's okay. I'll get more. Okay, so here's the exercise. I want you to take at least 3 minutes, okay? I'll time you. 3 minutes right now to just observe your object. Just observe it.
3 minutes?
3 minutes. I'm going to time you. 3 minutes. Observe it. And then I want you to write a little bit afterwards. 3 minutes of that and then a couple minutes of writing. What are you observing? And what is it saying to you right now in your life, personally? What can you learn from this object? Okay, go. Okay, let's wrap up and come back together as a group. Okay, good. Just for the microphone, I just want to say that we are, we've just done a Hit Lam Du exercise where we've looked at sources and one more obvious source, one less, and how does it apply to our lives. So I'd love to hear reactions from people. Just kind of both meta, like what that was, what it was like trying to do the exercise, and then if there's any particulars people want to share. But what was that like, practicing Hit Lam Du? Either with natural world or Torah. Yeah.
So I really like the idea of the walnut I was looking at happened to be beautiful, but even if it hadn't been beautiful, The idea of looking at something that's kind of absurd and trying to find meaning in it, I think is really, really a wonderful practice. It actually kind of reminded me of like the basic idea of improv, which is saying yes and, so like, what can I learn from this? How can this benefit me in a productive, positive way?
Oh, it's great. I hadn't heard that connection yet with improv. That's right. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you. Yeah.
I think what you've given us here is a kind of two types of Rorschach tests. So
yeah.
You know, the improv, and then you see the form that the improv has, and you reflect the way you're seeing in the improv. So you probably describe your leaf or your walnut or whatever you've got as a date to some perspective of what's going on in your life, perhaps. And then also with this text, if it's ambiguous, you perhaps see different things than that to someone else, depending on your mindset.
Right. So it's a highly subjective practice. And that was very important to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, that we acknowledge our subjective minds, that there was kind of an idea out there that we can objectively understand Torah and truth and all this kind of stuff. And he was very revolutionary in saying that, like, we have subjectivity and that we have to really understand that subjectivity. And he wasn't saying everything's relative, wasn't going that far, but saying we have to understand what we're bringing to the sources, to the text. So Musar is really a combination of both the highly subjective and then Torah and coming into that relationship. Yeah.
I don't know if I'm jumping ahead. This is just a question. So this is highly subjective.
process, is it something that you also share with others? In this group, where we're working in partners, but when you asked at the beginning, how many do you practice Musar? Is that just my own personal practice, or is it something that I share?
So I'm going to get to that. I want to see if there's other comments here, and then we're going to move into practice and what practice looks like in a couple minutes. Other comments on this exercise? Yeah.
Sure. One thing I noticed is like I received this stimulus. Like this something new came into my field.
Right.
And the first thing that happened was it just like mirrored all of the Mido thing that we had. Hmm. So it like incited my like all of this stuff. I was like, how much attention can I get with this leaf right now? Or like it like just incited like my stuff. And then I was like, okay, how present can I be with this leaf?
Yeah.
And like, how can I drop into like the sensation of it?
Mm-hmm.
And then how can I like receive its sensation in present time now? And just how that like just drops into like an ability to create space for change rather than like, but, like this initial like intense stimuli and like resolve.
That's a lot from one leaf, you know? It's like it's very, very rich, very rich. Other comments? No? Okay. So this is a practice. And when we do Musar, we do Musar practice, we work on Hit Lam Dut all the time. It's where we start, and we keep coming back to it over and over, of taking the stance of learning, no matter what. So things become alive for us. Things become real. That was so key in Musar, that, again, not rote living. We're alive, we're awake, and this wakes us up. Okay, I want to talk about practice. If you can flip the sheet over. I must have given away the last one. Is there an extra sheet that had the Torah? There's a bunch. Okay. All right. There are three modalities in which we practice Musar. There's the modality of what's called the Vod. A Vod, or group, is a group of people that are working on either the same Midah or we'll go through different midot, who come together periodically. I think the ideal way is every other week. Some meet every week. And a vod consists of people talking about their experiences with the midah and then learning Torah about either the next midah they're going to take on or more Torah about that particular midah, and then choosing a practice or practices that they're going to go do going forward. And this has been, there's no kind of, you know, set in stone way of doing these things. They've developed over time. Back in the days of Yerushal Salanter, in the beginning of the Musar movement, in the yeshivas, they were groups of guys who were living together, would work on a particular midah, and they would do a self-estimation. Someone would say how they thought they were doing with humility, then everyone else would tell them how they thought they were doing with humility. We don't do that anymore, or at least I don't, and none of the people I've trained with or do that. It's a much kinder, gentler Musar today. Where the groups really are about giving a safe space for people to talk about how they're working with the Midah and maybe asking questions and stuff, but really not advising, not moving into that type of thing to really keep the space safe. So there's the group. And it's incredibly important to have a group. I don't know how you do this without it. I think it's theoretically possible to do it without it, but I haven't really been successful with that, which is one of the reasons I teach, because it keeps me in it. I've been practicing this now for 17 years. And it's when I'm in groups that really my practice is most alive. So that's a vod. And again, those meet every couple weeks, and they can just go forever and ever, you know, or they could just go 8 sessions and then stop. So that's the vod. The second is the chevruta, partner. And this is it's not necessarily a text learning chevruta. It'd be more what Rabbi Nachman of Breslov calls a sichat chaverim chevruta, which is a discussion among friends about spiritual matters, where you have someone you're checking in with at least once a week about your spiritual life and how's it going, and particularly about the midah, if you're working on a particular midah. Those relationships, people really can become more intimate than the vod, than the group. It can be a place where there's a lot of safety and are really important, because like any, if you do Weight Watchers, you do any, you know, any kind of behavioral change process, which Musar is, you have to have accountability. And so to have the group, to have your partner that you know, okay, I have to say, did I do my practice or not? That's incredibly important to making it actually happen. So we have the group, we have the individual, the partner, and then we have the individual. The most important is the individual, because if you don't do the individual practices, you're not going to grow. You're just not going to grow. It's, you can think about it, it could be in your mind, but you have to do the practices. So what are the practices? So let's take a look at the sheet. At the top it says kavod practices. Kavod means dignity and honor and respect. So this week we're working on, for example, we're working on kavod. That's what we do. We study in our vod about Torah, about kavod, and then these are the practices. So we get our practice sheet, and here are the different practices. So Torah learning. So we want to keep learning about the midah. That's what makes, one of the things that makes Musar different than some other more secular growth type thing, because it's based in Torah. So we want to learn what, you know, the Torah sources say about this midah. And so a couple examples here, Al Eshor 2, which is Rav Shlomo Volbe's book, has a chapter on kavod, so see what he has to say. Or Alan Mernis's Everyday Holiness, which I think is the best English language Musar book that's available. He's a chapter on kavod. So okay, study. So you take it and you're going to study. Hopefully study every day a little bit. Focus phrases. A focus phrase, it's like not a complicated practice. There's really a focus phrase we say in the morning, something called the Kabbalah, which is a small challenge we take on during the day, and then a cheshbon nefesh, journaling or review, soul accounting at the end of the day. That's it. That's the practice. It's like it's elegant. It's simple. So a focus phrase is something that gives us points our mind in the direction of a particular midah. So if we're working on kavod, this is something we would say out loud in the morning for about a minute, 2 minutes every day. So, you know, I did mine this morning, you know, after I had my breakfast, I sat and I could have said my focus phrase out loud. It's very important to do it out loud because it just does something different to your mind when you're saying it out loud. And when you're saying it in your head, unless you're really good at meditation, it could end up you're thinking about what you're doing the rest of the day. I can kind of, so saying it out loud is very important. So here are a few examples. So they're a little clunky. You want to make them, you know, really your language so you can use them. But using psukim, using verses from Torah, from Proverbs, from Psalms can be very powerful. So here's a couple. Rav Volbe, kavod is external behavior mandated by and appropriate to a reality of inner holiness. That's pretty clunky. You don't want to probably try to change that to your own language. But what he's saying there is that kavod is based on, the kavod you give someone, the kavod you have for yourself, is based on understanding that there's inner holiness. Ezu mechobad, the mechabed tabriot, who is honorable, one who honors all others. That's a nice one, you know, that's nice and elegant. And that's the idea. So you say these, some people write them on an index card and put them somewhere. Some people put them on the dashboards of their car, you know, so they say them while they're driving. Some people put them on their computer. When computers used to take time to boot up, you can say it while it's booting up. Mine still does take time, so I can do it then. But a minute in the morning, and that gets your head focused. And then you can carry it with you during the day. And this is that we do have, actually, from our sources of a rabbi's, like, having psukim in their heads, having verses in their heads that they would say over and over. So that's one. The second practice is called the Kabbalah. And it's a Kabbalah, probably comes from, it means to receive. Kabbalah is receiving something. The Kabel, it probably means that in the old days, the master would give the student something and the student would receive that practice from them. So we still call it a Kabbalah. And it's a small challenge that will do two things. It will evoke, because it's an action, it will evoke something from your inner life, from your unconscious, that wouldn't be in consciousness otherwise, and then you can work with it. And it can habituate. If you do it long enough, it can habituate you to a behavior. So Rav Volbe recommends this one. He says, choose one 30-minute period during the day, and during that time, do whatever you can to honor anyone who comes your way. Okay? So that could be in the school where I work. We say, do it at lunchtime. You know, and so that lunchtime, you're going to take on. Now, remember, you're doing it hit lamdut. You're going to meet lamed to do this. So you're going to practice, anyone who comes my way, I'm going to honor them. And now you have to figure out, like, what that is. Rav Volbe says, it's very creative. Giving honor is a very creative act. You can't just, like, smile the same way at every person because someone may need something different from you. So it's creative. But you're giving yourself 30 minutes. So it's the Kabbalah is, it's measurable. And you can tell, did I do it or did I not do it? So if you set that up, I'm going to do this at lunch. By the end of the day, you'll be like, oh, I totally forgot. So then you know in your journal, like, I forgot. And then you try again the next day to do it. But it should be something that you can tell if you did it or not. And you do that for a week, 2 weeks. You know, it depends. In my groups where I run every 2 weeks, we'll do this for 2 weeks, sometimes a month. That's a lot. But you find a time that you're going to interact with people. That's a Kabbalah. Another one is do one thing each day that demonstrates kavod for yourself. Some people have a hard time giving themselves kavod, giving themselves dignity. So one thing each day. And then you got to plan that out ahead of time, what it's going to be. And then the last part is cheshbon nefesh. End of the day, okay, what happened? I tried my Kabbalah. What else did I notice about Kabbalah during the day? What else did I notice about anything during the day? Remember, the cheshbon nefesh is really helping us do the hergesh, doing the inner sensitivity to understanding our inner lives and tracking our inner lives. And that's it. Like, that's the practice. There's some other fancy things you can throw in, like this his palut, fervent chanting practice. But this is basically it. And when you do this, over time, with a group and with a partner, you will change. It does change your life. I've been doing this for 17 years because after about 4 or 5 years of it, my wife said, wow, you're changing. And so that's your best tell. If you have a partner, a life partner, they can tell you if it's actually working or not. But that's, you know, this is really the practice. We have a couple minutes. I just want to see if there's any questions on the practice. Then I'll wrap up with one thing. Yeah.
So if you have a fabruja or a group, and say you're all, are you always all working on the same one at the same time, or does it fluctuate? I guess that's the first part of the question. And then the second part is, are there specific ways that you would support each other, or by just talking it out and seeing where each other?
People have tried to have these groups where people are working on different midot, and it has not worked. So it's best we stay on the same midah, so everyone has a common ground, and then yeah, we help each other. You know, if you have your partner, it's more like peer coaching, really. These conversations, these chavrutas, and then you come together. I try to stay away from advice giving. It's just these things can devolve very easily into a lot of advice giving, and so I think for facilitators who do this, we train them to not do that. You know, and maybe we'll talk at the general level about Amidah and how it works, but a person can check in with their facilitator how to do it. But I find that doesn't go well when you start opening up to a group for a lot of advice. Yeah. Other questions about practice? Yeah.
How do you find Amidah?
That's a great question. I mean, one, you can, it's great to have a group of friends and just do it with a group of friends. That's really the best way to do it. Then you need to find a teacher or someone to facilitate it. It's good to have someone who knows this practice, the facilitator, for at least a year. Maybe 2 years, and then you can really run on your own once you have that and just check in. You know, I was talking with one of Rav Olbe's main students, Rabbi Yehuda Mendelson, about this recently, and he was saying what they would do is, and these are all like Talmidei Chachamim, these guys, and what they would do is they had their VOD and they'd work on their own, and then they'd go meet with Rav Olbe every 2 to 3 weeks and just check in with him how it was going, but it's really on your own. So yeah, it's just you pull a group together, and then you just need to find someone who knows it who can help you get started with the practice. Yeah. If you read modern Hebrew, Ali Shor by Rav Olbe is really an amazing resource, and I'd recommend it. Okay. Yes.
Do you ever find yourself, staying with one midah for a long time, and then moving on, and then coming back to it later?
Yep.
Is it sort of like falling out of your practice?
Well, the way the practice works, I'll say this, and then we're gonna have to wrap up. The way the practice works is, in general, is you have a midah, work on it for a little bit, move on to another midah, which, there was a system of 13 midot during the year, and you do one each week, and then through the year, that's what I do, and through the year, you end up going through it 4 times. Rav Olbe worked on a midah for like a year, you know, so there's different ways of doing it, but there's a Musar joke about working on a midah and moving on that guy was begging for money, going door to door, and he came to the Musar guy's house and he knocked on the door, said, "Give me tzedakah." He said, "Oh, too bad you didn't come last week when I was working on tzedakah." But you always come back to them, you know? You keep coming back to them. So listen, write my address down. I want you to be in touch with me if you want to find a group, if I can be helpful in any way. David Jaffe, my name, David, and Jaffe's Jaffe 10. DavidJaffe10@gmail.com. Definitely be in touch with me. You know, Rav Olbe says that with practice and with the Musar practice, there's no reason for Yeyush. Yeyush means despair. Like anything you hit, any problem you hit, like we have a way to work on it. We have a way to do it. Yeah.
Super quick. Do you have any books that you recommend?
Yeah. So Everyday Holiness. If you're English, for English readers, Everyday Holiness is the best book. I would say two: Climbing Jacob's Ladder, and then Everyday Holiness. What? Climbing Jacob's Ladder by, and both are by Dr. Alan Marinus. Oh, thank you. Oh, yes. And then, go ahead, why don't you say?
There's a project that Rabbi Jaffe and I actually both agreed to, we found out different information. It's called Making Menches. what makes, yeah, the making of a mensch. And Tiffany Schlein, who makes a lot of Jewish content accessible through YouTube videos for young people, especially if you're an educator, it was really cool videos. The making of a mensch brings together a lot of different thinkers of Musar and also combines it with Kabbalah, that's in conversation. Maps it out, like it's a periodic table of the elements that are building blocks of the world. So you can work on it. So if you have questions around, talk about that resource.
Yeah, this is a great resource that's out there. So, talk to Debbie?
Deborah,
yeah. Talk to Deborah and Google Making of a Mensch. It's a good resource. My voice is, I have a voiceover in it,
yeah,
so you can
yeah.
try to find it. And then the last one I'll say, I have a book coming out in October called Changing the World from the Inside Out, A Jewish Approach to Personal and Social Change. And it takes Musar practice and also some Hasidic practices and moves it out of the inner and the interpersonal to the social realm. To making social change as one unified practice. So that'll be available in October. But you can pre-order on Amazon today. So do that. Okay, yeah, but definitely be in touch. You're welcome.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.